We're talking with Adam Gorightly and Greg Bishop about their book, A is for Adamski. There are some names in here that you might recall, but you may not have thought of them as contactees, one of them being Charles Hixon. You might recall a couple of months ago, we had Calvin Parker on the program, and he recanted the, told us the story of their abduction experience, one of the most famous abduction cases in the world. But what I didn't know until I read this book is that his partner in that event, Charles Hixon, who was out with him fishing on the night of the events that were described by Calvin, had ongoing contacts and very disturbing experiences. We'll hear that story and also the story of Omnek Onek, who says she was born on Venus when we come back. Adam or Greg, I'm not sure which of you would like to take this one, but the story about Calvin Parker surprised me. Which of you wrote that chapter? Or Hixon.
Yeah, I wrote that one. I suggested that to Adam, actually.
So go ahead and dive into that. I did not know these other details. We all know, of course, we've heard about Parker and Hixon and their abduction experience, but did not realize that Hixon had ongoing encounters.
Yeah, that actually surprised me, too. I found that out by reading the book he wrote with, I think, a man named Menendez, called UFO Contact at Pascagoula. I think it was written in the probably in the early 80s or maybe late 80s. Anyway, what Hixon described was, you know, everything they went through, obviously, with the original abduction in October 11th, 1973. But what happened after that, after they, you know, stopped their jobs and all that, their lives went into turmoil from talking about this. So early the next year in 1974, Hixon said he was out hunting. He was squirrel hunting out in the woods in Mississippi. He said, or Louisiana, he said that he was sitting against a tree, like having lunch or something. And he said, suddenly the whole place got quiet. Like people say that happens, that Oz effect during a UFO encounter. And he said he saw some sort of ship resting a few hundred feet away from him. And a voice in his head said something like, we mean you no harm. We have a message that you have to deliver, and you have been chosen to give this message out. Now, to me, that is a 100%, you know, a very contactee type of experience. He had another one later, but he didn't see anything. I think his dog was barking at something outside, you know, behind his apartment at the time. He went outside, and he got another kind of a space brothery message. And then finally, I believe the year after that, him and his family, about five people from his family, were coming back from a Mother's Day gathering, and it was about twilight in the woods in northern Louisiana. They were coming back, I think, from a gathering in Texas or something like that. They were coming back through northern Louisiana, and they encountered a UFO sitting in the road. His whole family was there. They were all terrified. So there was a multiple witness event. But yeah, so there's a lot more to Charles Hixon's story than most people know. And he stuck to the story for the rest of his life. He no more contacts, I don't think, but he said that he felt like there had been some sort of communication and that he was chosen to give a message of peace and harmony to the earth, just like most other contactees.
Adam, there's a name in here that I did not know. I know the other names associated with it, that being rocket scientist Jack Parsons and Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. Their involvement with a lady named Marjorie Cameron. What's her story?
Oh, boy, that's a fascinating one. And you stated that you were surprised at some of the people included in the book, and maybe she would be one of those surprises like Charles Hixon. Because they're not your typical UFO contactee. What, you know, when you think of UFO contactees, but she was married to Jack Parsons, and we've become familiar with the story of Jack Parsons. I guess there's been a television series recently. He was a rocket scientist and ritual magician. Connected with L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology, and they conducted a series of rituals called the Babylon Working that are kind of legendary in magic lore. And at one point, according to the legends, and a lot of these things are legends, it's hard to pin down a lot of stuff, but when they're out in the Mojave Desert, they conjured or had an encounter with some sources say a Venusian or another worldly entity. And around the time this was happening, Marjorie Cameron showed up, and her and Jack Parsons engaged in a long-standing affair and eventually marriage. And the first night she showed up at Jack Parsons' house, she claimed she saw a cigar-shaped UFO, and when Parsons heard that, he decided, well, this is the person that needs to be involved in the Babylon Working, these rituals, because the whole design of the Babylon Working was to call down a magical child into the womb of the participant, the female in the operation. That was going to be Marjorie Cameron. And so all of this was going on, and in 1952, that pivotal year and with contactees is when Jack Parsons died, and apparently his death happened the same time there was a sighting of over the Pentagon of all these UFOs and
July 1952, 2 weeks in a row, two weekends in a row, pretty dramatic.
And Marjorie Cameron took that as her own sign that there was great significance in all of this, and they tapped into something otherworldly. After Jack Parsons died, she, for several years, went to Mexico and lived in an artist colony. But then later in the mid-50s, she ends up at the area of Giant Rock. She was living in Pioneer Town, which is like a stone's throw from Giant Rock, and she befriended George Van Tassel, of all people. There's all these interweaving connections. And she was a very talented artist, and she painted quite a few portraits of interdimensional beings. And so all of this resonated throughout her whole life. You know, her interactions with Jack Parsons and the Babylon Working, and afterwards contact with, you know, perhaps these were interdimensional beings, but she had that connection throughout her whole life. And in the book, there's a photo I happened upon and published in the book of Marjorie standing in front of Giant Rock.
Yeah, all roads lead to Giant Rock. Omnek Onek, Greg. this is the one person you've got in the book that I interviewed. I interviewed her.
Really?
Yeah. It was an international UFO Congress. In the book, you talk about her speaking at one in Laughlin in 1991. She was at one here in Las Vegas. It's either 92 or 93. They held that same event here instead of in Laughlin, and I interviewed her. And she was wearing the silver suit. And so this lady's story is she's from Venus.
Yeah, she said that she was what's called, I guess, a walk-in, that there was a seven-year-old girl who died in a bus accident in Chattanooga, Tennessee in 1955, and she said that Omnek Onek entered her body and was raised as that child until she reached adulthood and then started to realize that she really was from Venus and that she had to tell people about this and make people aware of the, you know, the Galactic Brotherhood. Wendell Stevens published her first book. It's the only book I've ever seen. And like a lot of UFO contactee books, it's quite rare and expensive right now. It was called From Venus I Came. There's a picture of her on the front cover, and it's a good picture, too. It would sell a lot of books, her face. She was an attractive woman. I never met her. I never talked to her, but I did see her in at Laughlin and saw her wandering around. She's quite striking. She's still alive, as far as I know. I think she's had a stroke. She has, I think, four Earth children. And I found a reference to her from a former husband, who I guess, you know, gets along with her. He wrote a post on the internet called "My Ex-Wife Was Born on Venus," and talked about his life with her, how he came to believe her story, even though they weren't together anymore, and, you know, really couldn't find any holes in her story. Although I guess there's no way of proving it. So I guess
She was very straightforward about the whole thing. It seemed, you know, ridiculous on its face, but there was no guile involved. You make a point in this in the chapter of the book that she went on Jerry Springer, and I would assume that that was to make fun of her, but that she kind of impressed everyone because of her seriousness and credibility, you said.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these people get on these shows, and it depends how they take it. And she handled herself very well. She didn't really care whether people believed her or not, which I think is probably the best attitude to take when you have a story like this.
There was one of the accounts, I can't remember who it's about in the book, about a contactee who went onto a show with Jackie Gleason. And we know the stories about Jackie Gleason and his interest in UFOs, but it sounds like Jackie Gleason was out to gut this guy on, it was either television or radio. Do you remember which chapter that is?
I think it was Van Tassel, right? Right, Adam?
George King.
Oh, King, that's right. And you did the chapter on King, but I remember excerpting that from the Long John Nebel book. He actually transcribed some of that conversation with Gleason live on the air. He also Gleason was also a fan of Gray Barker, and he didn't take Gray Barker 100% seriously either, but he did tussle with him on the air as well. Maybe Adam can talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think you can find the actual interview on YouTube. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Long John Nebel shows, and Jackie Gleason would often call into Long John Nebel. And of course, your listeners are probably aware of Jackie Gleason had a really avid interest in ufology, had a huge library, had a home he built that was a flying saucer.
Yeah, we know the story about the story told by his widow about Gleason going with Nixon to an airbase to see bodies?
Yeah. So there's in Florida, yeah. So there's these legends about Jackie Gleason, and he was a fan of Long John Nebel, but he wasn't bashful of calling out those who he thought were full of it. And one of those was George King, who started basically saucer religion of Aetherius, which is still active in Los Angeles. In fact, Greg and I visited the Aetherius, what would you call it? The
Aetherius Society World Headquarters in Hollywood.
Yes, and so basically Gleason ran George King through the ringer and called him on the carpet for...
Another name I thought I was surprised is Ray Stanford, and I've communicated with him many times over the years, and always thought of him as a pretty nuts and bolts guy who had done great work trying to investigate the Socorro, New Mexico incident, sighting, famous UFO case. But you have him listed in this book as a contactee, and I guess he must have started pretty early. Greg, is that one yours?
Yes, it is. He started pretty early. He was in his teens. Him and his twin brother Rex were both interested in the UFO subject and got involved with the contactees early on. They used to visit with Adamski and Williamson and people like that. There's kind of a saucy story about him and Williamson in the book, which I won't get into right now, which was told to me by actually third hand by Jim Mosley at one point, but then Stanford told the actual story on my podcast at one point on Rudy Mysterioso. But yeah, early on they were doing channelings. They were doing exactly what all the other contactees did, both him and his brother. Rex went off to be a pretty well respected parapsychologist. Ray, I think the Socorro investigation probably turned him away from so much of the channeling and the Space Brothers stuff and more towards maybe what you would call a nuts and bolts view of what was going on. And this led him to capture a bunch of film and recordings of what he says are anomalous objects in the sky. And apparently they're pretty good, but he won't show them to anybody because he thinks people are going to misinterpret them or take them the wrong way or take them away from him or something like that. But yeah, his early, he's got two or three early books that could be considered right down the middle of a contact ebook. One of them was called Look Up. I think him and his brother wrote that.
Adam, what can we learn from the contactees that's useful as we sort of filter claims that are made now?
I'm not sure, but in your intro to the show, you were talking about being happy and enjoying what's going on in the world. And I get, you know, I always get that vibe from the contactees. Once again, it was a more innocent time, you know. Basically that.
Same question, Greg.
What about the
yeah, is there anything we can learn from these cases that's useful for us as we interpret and absorb UFO claims today?
I think the usefulness of it is in there has been a turn recently towards listening more to the person that has the experience rather than sticking them in a, you know, in a category or just gathering data or whatever. And this has to do with an individual experience. You can't get more individual experience than the contactees. And so I think that some of the spiritual truths, some of the connections they made for themselves, some of the ways that they move towards their own happiness are very relevant to us right now. You don't have to believe what they said and in, you know, literally to take them seriously in a spiritual way. As a friend of mine said that studying paranormal stuff, she said, Shannon Taggart, she said, people don't understand that I take this seriously, but not literally. And I think that's a really good attitude to have.
You know, there's several of the examples that you use. They become religions. They become, in essence, prophets of their own religion or, sort of the
ego priests. Gets involved.
Yeah.
And when the ego gets involved, it's kind of the thing where you have a spiritual awakening and you think you found the answer. So you must think you're the person with the answer. And you get a few people around you who think you do have the answer. It's really good to get. It's really easy to get into kind of a guru feedback loop. And I think that happened quite a bit with a lot of these contactees. But I don't think, with the exception of people like Marshall Applewhite and possibly Claude Vorilon or Rael, I don't think that these contactees and the leaders of these movements really abuse these people's trust.
You get a sense, Adam, of any of these, and it's hard to, from the prism of 2018, to look back and say, this gal had a legit experience, and then they built on it, you know? They got a thrill out of the attention they got, so they started making stuff up after what appeared to have been an actual encounter.
Well, that seems to be the cases with, the case with a lot of the contactees. I won't speak to anyone specifically off the top of my head, but they had some type of an encounter, whether it was a UFO or whether it was a spiritual encounter, which they perceived to be otherworldly entities, and they shared those experiences with the greater world, and people were receptive to that. And, you get into that position where, okay, I'm kind of a star on the scene. People are listening to me, and I have a greater message about universal love and these type of things. And there's a tendency with some people to
come up with new material.
Yeah.
We're talking with Adam Gorightly and Greg Bishop about their book, A is for Adamski, The Golden Age of the UFO Contactees. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines. We're talking with Adam Gorightly and Greg Bishop. A is for Adamski is the name of their book, talking about UFO contactees. And, in a moment, we'll get into a couple of examples of, the danger of being cosmically roofied. Some of these contactees will tell you a story about Venusians or Martians offering them food and drink, and they just kind of take it, not thinking about the risks. At least that's part of their story. And then coming up at the top of this hour, we are joined by Australian researchers Paul Dean, Keith Basterfield, talking about Pentagon UFO programs that may or may not be underway right now. We'll be right back. So Adam and Greg, several chapters, several of the personalities that are described contactees in your book They say that when they encountered these aliens, that they were offered food or drink, and I don't think any of them turned it down. They all took it, and I'm thinking of Washington Irving, kind of a scenario where they feel really, really good. Weren't they worried about cosmic roofies or something like that? I don't know which
Well,
he wants
I
to.
can't speak for them, but yeah, there's some interesting stories there from Joe Simonton to Orfeo Angelucci. They imbibed of what was presented to them.
And none of them ever said, boy, this really tastes terrible.
Well, I don't think Joe Simonton thought much of the pancakes he was served.
Yeah, he said they tasted like cardboard.
That's right, yeah. You do go into in the book the connection or possible connection to hallucinogenics, psychedelics. And a lot of the people who gathered down there in the desert were into that. As you note, they were sort of precursors to what we'd call hippies today, exploring the outer edges of consciousness and other realms of reality through mushrooms or peyote or whatever. Did you get a sense from any of your contactees that that was a way to contact the others?
With some of them, yeah, it became a thing, especially later on in the in the 70s or late 60s or 70s, that kind of became part of the, so I've been told, the giant rock scene. And, you know, there was some interesting experiences. You know, I mentioned Orfeo Angelucci. He was one of the really early contactees and had some, what came across as quite genuine experiences. And, you know, those had to do with, on his first UFO sighting, he was on, coming back home from work, and like, quite a few of these guys, I'm thinking of Van Tassel, he worked in the aviation industry, which is kind of interesting. You start drawing some conspiracies here, but on his way back from work one day, he saw some saucers and stopped and noticed on the bumper of his car some elixir, which he afterwards drank, and that kind of set him on his path of discovery.
I know that at least one case, I think it was Howard Menger, you say in the book that his tune changed over the years, that years later he said, look, I recognize that maybe this was government agents planting this story, that they were fooling us. Greg, any indication that he was onto something?
Well, there might have been. In the mid-90s, I interviewed a man named Mario Pozzaglini. He said he had spoken with Ivan Sanderson, I believe, who was old paranormal researcher, classic paranormal researcher. He said he was at Menger's farm in New Jersey, where he used to have these meetings. And he said he went into a basement somewhere, and there were a lot of things that said U.S. Army or something on them. And he said Menger got very upset with him and said to get out of there. And that was some indication that maybe something was going on that was beyond just the innocent contactee scene. And the other thing was later Menger himself said that he sort of recanted and said, well, maybe my mind was controlled, or maybe I dreamed some of it or whatever. But then he recanted that later in life and went back to saying, no, the space buzzer really did contact me. So it seemed to, change with the, who was accusing him or how he felt at the time or how his life was going or whatever. So he kind of vacillated between saying they were real, saying they were imaginary, saying they were made up, saying the government had made him do it or was studying him so that they could find out how people reacted to such a thing. Because of the threat of subversion and communism and all that.
Somewhere along the line, as you guys note in the book, the overall message changed. Instead of the positive, peaceful messages of the Space Brothers, it became a very dark scenario, and in which these aliens didn't look like Aryans or Nordics. They looked like little grays who did terrible things, take people out of their homes and perform all kinds of probes that were not pleasant by any means. What was going on there? Adam, do you have a thought?
Well, that definitely happened at one point in the story. And in the introduction, we write about trying to encapsulize the period of the contactees and when they moved into the abductees. And, you know, just for conversation's sake, I pointed out 1978 seemed to be an important year because that's when George Van Tassel died, and there was a lot of mystery behind his death. Like, you know, you hear different internet rumors that he was almost done with the Integratron, which would be like a rejuvenation device, or, you know, this free energy device that would set us free, and something sinister went down. And around that time, 78, 79, 80, is when this meme, the dark age of ufology started. And I point to Greg's book on Paul Benowitz, and you know, a lot of those things started happening with these stories. That's when the alien grays appeared in underground bases. So there was definitely, I sense, a change in that late 70s, 1980s period, when we went from the golden age of the contactees to the more sinister abductees.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're going to go to Mel in the Mojave Desert on the wildcard line. Hey, Mel, how you doing?
Hi, fine. Good talking to you there, Mr. Knapp, longtime follower. I wanted to back up just a little bit to the giant rock portion there where you were talking about Frank Kreiser and everything. I went out to Giant Rock. That was my first road trip when I got my driver's license. It was the next day I drove out there, in fact. And I'd kept up with it years and years before that when I was much younger. You hear things over the years from the adults. And that was a lot more involved, the investigation into him. The FBI started all that. And, you know, what they did is they contacted a sheriff's deputy in Lucerne Valley that was somewhat friendly with Mr. Kreiser. He would go into Lucerne there and do his shopping for his goods and whatnot. That was the closest place to go back then. And anyway, the FBI agents approached the deputy, like I said, and then he would take a trip out there every now and then and befriend him more, and et cetera, et cetera. But there was never anything they could really develop on him over the time. And then, as your writer said, the FBI did go out there and to make an arrest, but they were going to arrest him on tax evasion because they couldn't really get him on anything else. And, you know, they pulled the old tax evasion out of the hat like they did with Al Capone, you know. And that's what they were really there to arrest him on. Just wanted to kind of clarify that for
you. So Mel, the first trip you took, the first drive you took anywhere when you got a license was to there, to Giant Rock?
Yes, sir. I was 1975. And I lived Apple Valley, 40 miles away. And I'd been itching to go out there, but I never had anybody around that could, you know, take me on a trip like that. So that was my first trip with my first girlfriend, by the way.
Greg, anything to ask of Mel?
Say that again?
I was seeing if Greg had a question for you.
Oh, anything, if I could help you. I wanted to mention real quickly, the cafe was still in operation then. And
The Giant Rock, the Come On In was still running at that point?
Well, I was still, you know, it was at the tail end of it there, you know, as you know, what year that Van Tassel died, what, 78, 79?
Yeah.
You know, it was the tail end of those days, but yeah, it was still in operation, and the rooms were still accessible under the rock, and there were two rooms, by the way.
Yes.
Okay, and I got to go down in them and everything and check it all out, and we had lunch there. We had burgers. That was one of the main things on the menu.
How were the burgers?
They were great. And, in fact, George Van Tassel's wife cooked them, Ava Van Tassel.
What I mentioned, Mel, was that Barbara Harris, who lives out in the area there now, has done extensive research on Kreiser. Mm-hmm. She probably could have told me what you said. Maybe not. But the one thing that fascinated me, which I mentioned, was that he may have been hiding Japanese families out in the desert so they wouldn't go to internment camps. Have you ever heard of anything about anything further on that?
No, honestly, and I don't mean to be contradictory in any way.
No, go ahead.
But I have never heard that. And one thing I'd really like to get out there, I don't know if you probably heard this in more modern times since, what, the year 2000, about the rock being split and fulfilling some kind of a Native American
prophecy. Yes, I wrote a story about it when it happened, actually.
I call that total hogwash. I don't mean to be contradictory again, but that's...
No, be contradictory. You know, it could be that, or it could be a combination of things.
What that was, in my opinion, was just...
Fires.
It wasn't so much multiple little fires, because that went out there for centuries, I imagine, you know, with the real Native Americans and campers over the decades.
And ice.
What it was a particularly cold, cold night, and some person, we'll say, went out there and decided to make an incredibly large bonfire right under that, where the natural portion was kind of semi-split, but it wasn't major, and that's the night that it busted.
Yeah, there were people camping out there, and they woke up at 8 in the morning, and they thought there was an earthquake, and they looked outside, and the piece had fallen off, and there was dust rising up next to it. So they were right near it, within a few feet, I think.
Wow.
Hey, Mel, thank you for calling and for sharing those stories with us.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to go west of the Rockies. Tom in Washington. Hi, Tom. You're on with Greg and Adam.
Hello, Greg and Adam. Hello, George.
Howdy.
I've had a curiosity about a book that's been in my possession for a long time. And it's called The Book of Urantia. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
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 Urantia, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 57 printing, and it's new. It's pristine. It's probably the 78 printing, but it was first printed in, like, 1955. And,
Greg, why don't you tell Tom what you can about Garantia and how it fits into the contactee movement?
Well, it's,
go ahead.
It details the universe and life as a whole, and culture, the culturing of humanity and life and everything.
Yeah, that's a channeled book that was channeled, I guess, in the 40s or 50s and gone through many, many printings. And I've never cracked that book. I've got a copy of it. Adam might know more about the history of it. Do you?
Actually, yeah, it dates back to the 1930s.
Okay, right.
And, yeah, the author of it was Dr. W.S. Sadler. And it was a channeled work that came from a group called the Overton Commission, whoever they were.
The Overtons, yes.
Yes, like some ascended masters. And, it, you know, that book has been a huge influence. I just recently discovered, I'm kind of a fan of the group Kansas, who were a big 70s band, and the mastermind behind Kansas, the guy who wrote most of the music and, you know, a lot of these songs that were heavily orchestrated, classical influences, was Kerry Livgren, and he was a big follower of Urantia up until a certain point in the late 70s, around 80, where he kind of switched over to Christianity. But, you know, it's a book that's been a huge influence over the years.
Well, that's not a casual project there. That thing is gigantic. I mean, it's highly detailed. It's not something you just channel in an afternoon.
No.
No, that's not at all. And I'm only about a quarter of the way through it. I'm just a sucker for a well-bound book with a really good paper. And the Urantia Foundation is no longer out there at all. You got plenty of callers. I got to go. Thank you, fellas. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Tom. We'll try to get one more in. Don in Kent, Ohio. Hi, Don. You're on with Adam Gorightly, Greg Bishop.
Brother George, hey, great show. Greg and Adam, good work. So, you know, about 3 years ago, I was on a longtime radio call-in talk show, and the interviewer, or the host, set up an interview with an alleged wife of an alien, and I told the host that she's putting him on. You know, I said, just give me 5 minutes with the girl. And he says, you got it. And so I spent about the first hour listening how she was, and this is a 5-hour program, how she was just snookering the listeners. And so I said, you know, the Bible tells us, you know, that we're to test the spirits in 1 John 4. And I said, you know, when you go to visit this other planet, I say, what day do you worship as the Sabbath? And she goes, well, we worship just the same on Earth, Sunday. I says, honey, the Sabbath has never been Sunday. It's always been Saturday. She decides to cut the program short by 2 hours, and it went downhill from there. So there's always, it seems like there's a spiritual side where these aliens are claiming to be, that they seeded the planet, that there are gods. There's so many things that they go against Scripture. And this is how you expose them. Jack Vallee was real interesting. He brought some stuff up about Fatima and the UFOs surrounded that. You know, George Norrie had L.A. Marzulli on, and he was exposing, you know, the UFO spiritualistic influences of Fatima back in 1917. So there is a spiritual side to this, very dangerous, I may add.
Don, let me get to some comments from Adam and Greg.
Thank you so much.
Gentlemen, do you get a sense, how often do these beings convey sort of a spiritual religious viewpoints, and are there any of these cases, I don't remember from the book, but are they anywhere they're in conflict with our own predominant religions?
Not really, no. I think they're coming through the lens of our religions, just because they have to come through the lens of our cultures and the way we deal with this, deal with things spiritually. It's just interpreted in slightly different ways, which is why I said earlier, I think the people that were unhappy with the religion that was being preached to them would go to some of these religions, because many of them were basically based in Christianity. In fact, almost all of them. They just have a different viewpoint of it. The only one I can think of that's right now that's way off of Christianity is probably the Raelians, and to some extent, maybe an, you know, Eastern-based, like George King and the Aetherius Society.
Well, Adam, go rightly. Greg Bishop, the book is called A is for Adamski, The Golden Age of UFO Contactees. I enjoyed it greatly. I recommend it. And thank you guys for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, George.
Thanks so much.
And we'll talk to you again. Coming up next, Paul Dean, Keith Basterfield. We talk about Pentagon UFO programs up to the minute. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.